to introduce our speaker, who is Mark DeSalvo, who is from Semaphore, and he's president and CEO of Semaphore. And he takes over troubled venture and private equity funds, is a new markets tax credit program provider, and advises general and limited partners around the world. Semaphore's corporate headquarters are in Boston, with principal offices in New York, Dallas, and London. And Semaphore currently holds fiduciary obligations as general partner or manager for 8 private equity funds. Mark is a frequent speaker at worldwide industry conferences. He was educated at UMass and has graduate degrees in political studies and economics. He's a longtime lecturer at the Johnson School of Business at Cornell University and the Kellogg School of Business, Warren went there, at Northwestern University in their full-time MBA programs. He contributes case studies in private equity, emerging market economics, and cross-border M&A. And so, Mark, welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Good evening, everybody. I appreciate the opportunity to have the head seat at the table. And I know that you've all contributed, perhaps some of you have been at this head seat as well in the past. I intend this to be a dynamic conversation between us all, somewhat a bit of a role play around true, in one case slightly disguised, circumstances that you might be able to contribute to, learn from, and move forward from there. Just a little bit more about myself. Marianne was kind enough to give you some of the vitae, but we do take over troubled venture and private equity funds. And when I mean troubled, I mean funds that have significant challenges, whereby a general partner may be committing fraud or very serious malfeasance, and value is precipitatingly falling off of the table, and time happens to be an enemy. And we get called in to arrest the circumstance, control that which can be controlled, and then do the things that are necessary to, number one, and this is most often the case, save reputation risk of our limited partner clients. Second is to take control of a situation and preserve value. And the third, and least important, oddly enough, is creating new value. I'm currently running 8 funds on a coterminous basis that had significant problems. Last year, we had 14 advisory engagements that did not turn into me being the permanent full-time general partner, but I take control, our firm rather takes control as the interim general partner in that circumstance. So that's a bit of the divide, if you will. The cases that we're going to talk about today, and I'm passing them out, are real-life circumstances. The first one, called Love Lost, is a current case. It is ongoing at the moment. We blinded the fact pattern just a little bit relative to industry and the like, as you might appreciate, but it is absolutely ongoing. And at the conclusion of our discussion, I'll give you a little bit of a view as to where we are at the moment. In my business school classes, I would call on one of you at this moment to give us a synopsis of the case. Seeing that you've just gotten it, I'm going to allow you the opportunity to read it while I give you a bit of synopsis.
Plus, we're taking your course pass-fail.
Thank you very much. No, you're on a grade scale. I promise you. And I'm going to give you a little bit of synopsis while you read about Love's Lost. But thereafter, it's a jump ball. And I'm a really good cold caller, so if you don't contribute, I'm going to point at you and ask for your contribution. You remember that from Northwestern, don't you, Warren? Okay, thank you. So we have a case where, check that. We have a case, this is a real live case, I apologize. I sent out case number 2 first.
No.
This is real. And I blinded none of the information. And what you have in front of the case is essentially a newspaper article recitation of what's happened. And the only thing that isn't correct is the name of the entity. So we'll deal in first names, if you don't mind, at the moment. And this gentleman had a problem, and his problem is that he fell in love. Unfortunately, he had a wife and a child in another city, and he fell in love with a person in a second city. And that person that he happened to fall in love with was a professional dancer. Dealing with poles, if you might understand what I'm talking about.
I do.
Given that I'm originally from Poland.
I'm about 6 foot tall.
I think we should stop while we're
ahead. I think you're on the clear in this one.
There were several union pension funds in this case, and it became public that he took a minimum of $2.4 million from his fund and used it for entertainment purposes in order to support his love interests with his second wife, shall we say. In addition to which, there were additional expenses that were used that he characterized as appropriate in order to support his portfolio companies and the ability to be able to search new opportunities. The gentleman, John, for the moment, said, okay, I haven't done anything wrong. I was using these monies for your benefit to his pension fund clients. He's in a meeting at this moment with his pension funds. And the pension funds have dismissed him, have set him aside, and the pension funds are asking themselves right now, as a de facto board of directors, what did we do wrong? Why weren't we able to discern what had happened? I open it up to you, ladies and gentlemen, as members of that pension fund advisory board. Lenny? Who wants to volunteer? Go ahead.
The question is, what from did what? We do wrong?
I guess the first question would be, what sort of control mechanisms were in place, like audits, accounting?
Well, what control mechanisms should have existed?
You know, should have invested, I mean, probably accounting as well as sort of process.
Okay.
You know, what are the processes? What are the checks balances?
So there was an audit of the fund done on an annual basis by a Big Four auditor.
Controls.
Ah, now that's an important distinction.
It's a very important distinction.
Yes, it is.
Well, all the auditors do when they, excuse me for saying this, is they check the numbers, right? And so they check the numbers and they look for detail and make sure. But we're talking about, you know, the process, the discipline, what are the rules of the road, so to speak, and are people sort of what we used to use internal audit. We'd have them go in and, one, make sure there were processes and disciplines, and two, make sure that the business processes and disciplines were looked at to ensure that nobody was doing anything running off the rails.
So in a fund, this fund particularly, there were a total of 7 or 8 employees. There was one key person, John, as the general partner. There were several lesser partners who are not tabbed as key people, and de facto a CFO, and that's it. So there were a couple of associates. Go right ahead, Scott.
So going from where Ellen was, how did the person, how did they get all this money out of the company? Was it just him signing checks himself? Was there anyone else looking at these checks before they went out? Did anyone approve these? What was the mechanism over?
It wasn't their oversight if they made capital calls for investments. Wasn't there some plan of action in terms of if you're going to do a capital call, you need to know what it's for and where the.
So first failing.
Back to the CFO. So there had to be, which you define that there was someone.
So the first failing was on behalf of the pension boards themselves and their level of engagement with the fund. There were three limited partners only. Only three limited partners. All three of them were on the advisory board. Only two regularly showed up. And when they showed up, I mean to a telephone call, and they were meant to have, under the rules of the limited partner agreement, two face-to-face meetings on an annual basis. They never once in the first 4 years of the fund had two meetings on an annual basis. And they only had one meeting for the first 3 years. So in the latter, essentially year and a half, there was no face-to-face engagement. Failing of the advisory board and the board of managers, we'll call them at the moment, a de facto board of directors.
How about the investment committee? Was there
the investment committee was the entire advisory board. In effect, all three pension funds were members of the investment committee. And the investment committee was pretty pleased because value was going up. They'd made six investments, one of which was a middling investment, three of which were performing enormously well, one in their own hometown in Detroit that they could physically see. It happened to be a hotel casino joint operation. So they could touch that investment at any moment in time. And it was going sterlingly well.
Gains covered up the bad behaviors.
Exactly. Exactly. So how hard do we look at a positively going enterprise is really question number one. And the lesson for this board is that you always presume that every number that you get is false. Always presume that. What other things ought to have been done in this circumstance in order to keep them from having this problem? What would you do as board members now? Please.
And Kevin.
Yes, Kevin.
Can you look at the process for controls that the CFO has in place, and shouldn't there be at least a two-level approval on any expenditures with documentation?
There was a two-level approval in place. That two-level approval was the CFO and the general partner, de facto chief executive. However, the CFO reported to the chief executive and did have a dotted line independent responsibility to the board as the quote-unquote chief compliance officer. The level of compliance was minimal. It was, did we file an audit and did the K-1s go out on time?
Well, board responsibility is to ask the chief financial officer each and every year in an interview, were there any things that they considered to be unusual or that caused them concern in the way business is being done? And it doesn't sound like that had been done at all.
Well, if I could, first of all, I think once a year isn't enough. Two, given the personalities and what you described, I mean, essentially the two of them are in it together, at least one is kind of blind-eyed. So the what I would do if I were on that board at that point, well, first of all, I'd fire a few people. But beyond that, to prevent it from happening, because you can never, if you've got two people who want to collude, it's really hard to prevent it. So what I would do is have external auditors who are following the cash and reporting directly to the board, not to inside management.
And would that internal auditor be different? It would be a private entity that you would ask to hold an internal audit role.
Correct.
Would that private entity be the auditor who's doing the books as well?
Nope.
It would not.
Nope, absolutely. You want it distinct and separate because that person or that group would be looking at, in addition to the numbers, they'd be following the cash and they'd be looking at the processes.
Is there another role for that independent group to have besides internal audit, a review, in effect, of where the cash flows are? What might that be?
The compliance.
Compliance to?
Regulations and to processes and you know, within agreements.
What about
compliance? Also their purpose. I mean, what's the goal of this fund? And are they needing what's been established in the documentation?
Mindy, you are exactly accurate. And you're in front of the curve here. That there ought to be a review, at least initially, particularly for, and this happened to be a first-time fund, by the way, with a first-time manager, that there ought to be a review of whether or not the fund is fulfilling its mission as defined in the strictures of the limited partner agreement. And there's an organization now called the Institutional Limited Partners Association, ILPA, ilpa.org if you wish. They are a professional association out of Toronto of about the 400 limited partners in the world who matter, generally in terms of size and in governance interest. Folks like CalPERS, many of the much larger state pension funds, the sovereign funds that come out that invest Social Security money in Norway and Sweden, for instance, where 100% of their dollars are invested in equity and private equity marketplaces. And they've established a group of guidelines called the ILPA principles. And I would strongly suggest that you view the ILPA principles, ILPA.org. And I'd strongly suggest that you view the ILPA principles and bring them to your board oriented interests at the very final portfolio, never mind fund level, but even portfolio oriented level. So if you sit on a corporate board, bring the patina of those ILPA principles to that interest. In addition to which, and this is a dead on for Mindy, they've suggested a best practice in the investment fund area to require what we have tabbed, actually we wrote the best practice, called a quality assurance program or quality assurance review. And the QAP or QAR doesn't look necessarily at financials, but it looks at all of the other underlying factors about operations in that organization. What is the flow of funds internally? Who touches what happens? Are you fulfilling the mandate of the organization? Is there a disconnect between what you've suggested to me is your source of deal flow, and have you actually done the work that suggests that you've looked at 60 deals and I currently am funding 4 deals, for instance? Where's the evidence that that work has actually been done? And we strongly recommend that for first-time funds and first-time managers, and in your circumstance, first-time experiences with CEOs and or startup entities that happen to be heavily supported, that you utilize those kind of institutional investment principles on your play. A couple of other wrinkles in our few more moments together on this case. Should it disturb you that there were 3 chief financial officers in the 5 years of the fund?
Oh.
Why, Warren?
I just said, oh.
Why?
Well, why the turnover? What's going on here?
A very good question. Don't you think that it should be asked?
I would. I just asked it.
No member of the board ever asked the question.
Red flag. Absolutely.
Yes. The first one is a pink flag.
Yeah.
The second one is a red flag. The third one is stop. It
means I work for the boss, but I feel uncomfortable about pointing a finger, so I'll just leave.
Yes. So there are those kind of pink flags that ought to go up along the way. I'll tell you, how do you think that this misapplication was found?
Fallout between he and she?
Close.
I didn't hear that.
Oh, the wife found out.
Oh, between the, oh, no. No.
I'm saying between the lover and him.
No.
And there was something.
No.
The wife?
No.
The first board meeting was at the Crazy Horse.
No.
Good thought.
What was it, a past CFO?
A past CFO. It happened to be an employee, not the CFO. And the employee was a junior general partner, if we can call him that. And he happened to call up a limited partner, a board of director member, and said, I just want you to know that you won't be dealing with me any longer. I'm leaving the company. I've really enjoyed our interaction. I hope that we can continue to talk together. And thankfully, this board member asked the question that Warren asked a little bit earlier, why? Why are you leaving? Well, I'm just a little uncomfortable. Then she, in this case, dove in and said, well, why are you uncomfortable? And they started a conversation. And this person was never intimate as to the fact that money was disappearing, didn't know that there was a second family, but said merely, you know, there's one or two investments that John doesn't allow us to ever discuss. And, you know, the reason I'm leaving is because he made me a promise of a $10,000 bonus, and he's not paying me the $10,000 bonus that I've earned, and I just can't work for somebody that doesn't fulfill their obligations to me. And out of that came a phone call to me.
From whom?
From the investor, the board of directors, if you will. And it took me about 20 minutes of walking in the door, ostensibly to do a valuation, an independent valuation, of the fund itself to discover what had happened. And my very first conversation was with the CFO. That gentleman who left the company, who wasn't paid the $10,000 bonus, wouldn't speak with me, would not speak with me. But when I talked to the CFO, I of course got her CV, and it was a false CV. John manufactured her credentials to the board, and when I started to talk to her about her Notre Dame degree, mm-hmm. and discovered that she didn't go to college, that she did have an associate's degree, and she was at best a full charge bookkeeper.
So she gives you a resume.
She didn't give me the resume. I got the resume from the fund.
And she didn't know that.
And she did not know that her qualifications were falsified.
She did not know.
She did not know.
Oh wow!
I thought she was part of it. Like
no.
It's a made-for-TV movie here.
Yes. She did not know.
Resume?
Yep.
You couldn't dream this one out.
Wow. I'll tell you the end game. John stole $33 million.
Ooh.
And he stole it by making up two investments.
And those were the two that,
and those are the two that nobody would ever talk about. And the fund was a big returner, a highly, highly successful fund. And he never would have been found out if he'd paid that one person a $10,000 bonus. And John is now a guest of the United States government, doing 7 to 9 years.
Only.
Yeah.
Say again? Small bit of restitution, highly too small, about $2 million in assets. His the Bentley, the Jaguar, the penthouse apartment, the horse farm in Michigan were reclaimed, but no other assets were reclaimed. And interestingly enough, John's wife and children have stuck by him in Michigan.
And where did the rest of the money go?
It went to gifts and entertainment and Lord knows.
High living.
Yes, very high living.
Somewhere offshore somewhere?
No discovery of that. Yes, sir.
There's still a piece of this puzzle that's not there, and that's the communication between the board and the different stakeholders.
So who are the stakeholders? Who are the definition of stakeholders first?
Well, I would think the unions.
Yes.
And the individual union members.
Very good.
Because one of the things I'm impressed with is how VW has been handling their crisis, and they're over communicating. They got rid of the CEO. So they start at the top, and now they constantly are communicating what they're doing, which I think is the right thing to do. So I think they're a very good model, but I think the issue is, if I was on the board, we need to hire a communications professional to help us manage these communications.
I will relate to you that, do you agree, by the way, that the stakeholders happen to be those union workers in those three funds?
That's true.
Whose hard-earned dollars, their contributory retirement system in effect, was abused. And it was abused by the inattention of the board to fulfill their fiduciary responsibility. So the bad behaviors really are spread, and the people truly paying the price happen to be the folks on the line in Detroit rather than anyone else. Truly, those are the people.
But it also, when you look at the fact that they had a good track record, these people got lulled into something.
Yes, they did get lulled into something. And while the fund actually is a performer, it's in the top quartile of all of their other funds, it is less beneficial than it ought to have been. And to this day, other than public dissemination, there's never been a communication from the pension funds directly to their members around their mistake.
They're fall out with the board members?
Still there.
Same board members?
Excuse me?
Same board members?
Same board members.
And so what actions have they taken?
They've taken two specific actions.
Firing a bunch of people and hiring new people.
Number one, it's my understanding that they have nominated an outside party to be responsible for monitoring, for sitting in effect on all advisory board seats. So they've essentially fired themselves from the board of directors of the investments that they've made. And two of the three, forgive me, have put together this additional process. And the second was that they have hired, which is not atypical any longer, they have hired a consultant to vet investments before they get to their vote. So no investment can be voted on by them unless it passes an independent review board, if you will, via a consultant like Wellington Management here in Boston, among others, or Cambridge and the like. Mike.
I'm wondering about the audit firm. So the CEO created two of the six investments and used it to siphon off, I don't know how big the fund was, but $33
million. $200 million.
Okay, so 15-18% of all the monies were channeled off. And the audit firm obviously gave them four four reports. The integrity of what they had looked at was valid. I don't see how they can do that?
Well, depending how complicit you wish to be.
I wonder how he hid those two investments that he wouldn't talk about.
They were papered, a la Madoff.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were papered.
They were papered.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, and they were quick, dead deals. So within the audit year, the money was lost. And the auditor's responsibility was to review the papers. Except now, in this case, there was a resolution with the auditor for, because this has never been made public, I will not make it public now, but for a reasonable sum of money, because the auditor's liability policy agreed that the auditor ought to have had some more responsibility for discovering what was not discovered.
How many years did it take?
3 years.
Wow.
I mean, I say this because I don't think it's analogous to what Madoff did. The Madoff transaction was dramatically simple compared to what you would have to synthesize for two operating companies. I got my start 40 years ago as a lender, and candidly, we had to go to very granular levels of detail to validate what was going on with the businesses we were lending money to.
Well, these were equity investments, which made the case significantly easier.
Yeah.
And they wrote it off, so it wasn't on the books.
And then they were written off, so they weren't on the books.
Right.
So it balanced. The level of depth of review ought to have been higher,
yeah,
but it balanced.
I have a question.
Yes, sir.
The case, there's an implication in the case that's never explicit, and that is someone on the board recommended this individual. So was there ever a kind of a search done to find a leader, or was it really, well, Ellen recommends Joe, so Ellen knows what she's doing, so if it's good enough for Ellen, it's good enough for me, and that's the end of it.
The deal came up to the board independently, and one member of the board did have a minor relationship with John. And it was an appropriately vetted deal, and you and I would have invested in John, very frankly. Highly qualified person, albeit a first-time experience as a fund manager. But the failing happened to be first John's, which was he fell in love, and or in lust at least, and it clouded behaviors and caused inappropriate behaviors, and the laziness, frankly, egregious laziness of a board, and colored by the fact that the fund was legitimately doing well.
So the CFO, whatever you want to call the person.
Yes.
Did he know this person before? And like, why did he cover, like, did he know this person was going to just, like,
No. None of the CFOs was aware of what was going on, and the last person, who was not a qualified CFO, was being highly overcompensated for something that she had no capacity to be able to understand, and was told very simply, this is the way we do things in this industry.
That's what I was wondering. That's why I thought he might have hired her. So
yes, that's exactly why he hired her.
He probably learned his lesson from, so he had to find someone.
Exactly correct. Exactly correct. So case number two.
Oh, boy.
Get to be more fun.
Yes, which is called Ain't No Sunshine.
One for you.
Thank you.
We'll have to monitor the time carefully.
If you're being entertained and learning something, we'll just go over time. Are we good with that? Okay, good. So we'll give you all the opportunity to read case number two while I give you a little synopsis of it. There's a company called Exeter Astra, led by an extremely qualified top-line person named Brianna Hayward. And she's the CEO of this company. And $44 million has come into this company. And principally that $44 million is from one fund called the Thames Capital Fund, run by Ed Foley. Ed Foley happens to be both the principal capital investor and chairman of the board of Exeter Astra. It's an 8-year-old company. It has not been doing particularly well, but it's got a passel of significant patents and intellectual property. And it had been supplying its intellectual property principally to the consumer industry, quite literally polymers and coatings for the sunglasses industry, binoculars as well, optical kind of interests. The company was not even break even. It was expected to be break even 3 years ago in an 8-year-old entity, and it didn't get there. Brianna believed that the entity ought to go heavily into a non-consumer oriented places where there is significantly more revenue possibility in the solar and semiconductor space, among others. Ed said, no, I'm not going to let you move into that space. I can't let you move into that space. I can't give you any more money. But Ed, Brianna says, it will only cost $5 million to do that. And he says, no, I can't do that. I'm not going to let you do so. Brianna independently goes out and raises money from a third source, in this case, a sovereign fund out of Asia. And without notice to Ed, other than 24-hour notice before a board meeting, says, I want you to know that I'm creating a new joint venture, that Exeter Astra is going to be a joint venture partner in this new entity. I've got a new investor. I don't want any of your money. And you will own now 7% of that new entity. The old entity, they owned 44% of. And I'm resigning as CEO, and I'm going to take over as CEO of the new entity, of the joint venture. Ed is furious.
Can I ask a question about ownership?
Please.
So if in the company Esther Astra,
Exeter we'll call it,
Exeter, Thames owns 44%, who owns the other 56%?
Other investors and management.
They're the largest single investor?
They're the largest single investor.
Is there a contractual arrangement they've made saying, you know, triggers, you can't do this, you can't do that, we have a big stake in this business?
Nope.
Nothing contractually that
nope. Older. Other than what actions take place under the aegis of the board meeting and or by stockholder vote.
But I'm still interested in the makeup of the rest of the stakeholders. So this is a private company.
It's a private company. 44% owned by Thames, let's say another 25% owned by other investors, but a myriad number of them. Thames is clearly the larger shareholder, and management owns the rest, some overhang in an option pool as well for employees. The company's never made money.
What is the board comprised of?
The board is comprised of two of the investors, two independents, and Brianna, the CEO.
Ed being one of those two?
Ed is one of those two investors. Brianna brought
two investors, two independents.
Two independents, and Brianna, who brought some reasonable amount of personal funds into the company as well. So she was an initial investor. So she has some alignment with all of her other investors.
Question, when Brianna was hired, do you know if she signed a non-compete?
Brianna,
disclosure agreements?
Brianna was a founder, and she was an equity investor as well, so she wasn't hired, if you will. Okay. She brought herself to the table, and they're in a non-compete state, and there was no other restriction other than the protection of intellectual property. And she had authority, please. And she believes that she had authority to create this new entity and has completed the creation of the entity. No money came from the company other than the transfer of rights to use the intellectual property in a space that the company said it would not, the board would not allow the use of that intellectual property. Brianna has accepted herself from the board meeting. Ed is wild, absolutely wild. Should he be?
What's the comparative valuation of 44% to 7%?
It's a very good question. It's nominal at the moment, because $5 million has gone in. It's essentially a holding company that will be selling intellectual property and nothing more. So the $5 million came in from another party. They own 46% of the new entity for $5 million. So it's valued, round numbers, $11 million. And management owns the rest, and Brianna is the largest shareholder on the management side. So essentially 48 or 49% is owned by management, and she owns 30 plus percent of that.
But her board told her definitively, we're not going into that space, we want nothing to do with that space, focus over here to the right.
That's correct.
And so essentially she went out, transferred the rights, and said, this should be a good business. You guys keep the business you want to stay focused on. I'm going to try and make something out of.
However, doesn't Exeter still own that intellectual property?
Exeter owns the intellectual property, and she, without specific board approval, transferred the rights for use of that intellectual property to another entity.
She didn't sell them. She, for use, did they pay a licensing fee?
They paid in exchange for the ownership, the 7% ownership in the new entity.
So if you believe the valuation, which is questioned.
Yes.
Then
she sold them for $700,000 in effect, in terms of valuation.
Do we know if she really had authority to do that? Put aside whether it's pissed or not. Did she have authority?
She believed she had authority to do so, and whether she did or did not, it in fact happened, and the entity exists. Okay. We're at the board meeting. Should we be angry at Brianna? Should we be angry at Ed? The board never said to her, you cannot enter this business. It was Ed who suggested, look, I can't support you. I'm not gonna give you money,
no more money
to enter
either.
This
from,
business
from
me.
No more
from
money
Tim.
From me.
Exactly.
I got it.
Exactly.
The intellectual property was developed under this company's umbrella, the original company's umbrella.
It was.
And so it belongs to the company. The board should have some voting rights, I would think, over where it goes.
Maybe not. She had authority to sell
funds.
Okay, she, you make deals.
CEOs make deals every day. You know, but it's a major asset.
It's a major, yeah.
It's a major asset of the business.
Well, it's an asset of the firm, but is it being utilized? It's a spent asset.
But, you know, anyway you look at it, I mean, she's conflicted. And, her positioning the first conflicts with the other, and she's conflicted.
So if she never joined the new company as CEO, would this have been an appropriate transaction?
In a transaction like this, if you were an investor, you would reasonably expect that you have a right of first refusal on anything. And, you know, any sort of, stop dealing with major assets. You, as a board, have the right to approve it. I mean, it is not the decision of the CEO.
If he has his personal I don't think necessarily by entering
I'm with
into
you.
The new company and as such, because she became a larger shareholder, she's going to profit at the expense of her own company. So I think they have a right. I think she probably violated a few statutes, but it seems like the board didn't have enough oversight in terms of what is our mission as a company, or what are we set up to do, or where do we want to go, and what are the expectations of her?
So you say that she owed a further duty to her existing company, to Exeter.
I think so.
Well,
and to her colleagues
she
on the board.
The CEO. Then, she's doing the CEO's job of selling an asset, maybe getting some money from the company, but she still is at the helm of the original firm. Ed probably would have not have been happy about it, but say, okay, you stuck, we're not investing anymore, and you sold this thing off, you're still with us. Probably would have cooled a lot of, cooled some peppers.
She had an employment agreement, and she had her
full time and energies to building this business.
That's correct, and she had the right to resign at any time, and she chose to.
The $5 million for the new company, the people who invested that, are they aware of the rest of the situation? Are they involved?
Fully aware. In fact, they tried to make a similar deal with Exeter. And Brianna said, no, I don't want to make this deal with you at Exeter. Let's make this deal as a joint venture. So they tried to license directly the intellectual property, and Brianna said no. The board was unaware that she said no.
The thing, just to kind of come back from a board perspective, I'm just thinking of boards I'm on now as well as when I was in operating management. As a board member, we've always been clear with our CEOs the kinds of things that have to come to the board for discussion and approval. Sometimes it's just discussion, sometimes it's absolute approval. And so the question I would ask is, has this board, laid that out, and has she violated those agreements, or was this within her purview? I don't know the answer to that, but at least every board and I've been involved with, we've been very clear with our CEO what they need to bring to the board.
It's very, very clear that Brianna has carried this company on her back, and that she's been given very wide latitude by the board.
And she's a founder.
And she's a founder and principal of the company as well. So does she owe some other duty to her colleagues?
Yes, she does. She absolutely has the duty of responsibility as a member of the board for fiduciary responsibility to the company, number one. She has the
duty of loyalty?
Duty of loyalty also as a member of the board. And, just from an integrity standpoint, I don't even know where this would get covered in, insurance. She really took away future earning potential from that corporation. And she's going to profit from it herself.
Which is, I think, the piece that creates the problem. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If she weren't going to the other company and she had sold an asset, you could argue with her authority.
I can tell you, the board I sit on, we've had some proprietary technology, but we have clear responsibilities of the CEO in what level of asset disposition or licensing of technology. And we just licensed our technology to a Japanese partner, but in return for an exclusivity in the rest. So our company is benefiting from that. She didn't give her company the chance to benefit from this.
She will argue that she did. That the company, through its chair, said that we will not support moving into this new marketplace.
Should be a board resolution or a discussion on minutes or something versus a conversation that occurred between two members of the board. That doesn't resonate as official.
As directive.
Exactly.
And I think he was talking about his role as investor more than from than from a board perspective. So this should have been brought up to the board as a change in strategy versus him saying, no, I'm not giving you any more money.
What's the charter and how is it defined of that company's operating principles?
It's sort of an immaterial question relative to the fact pattern here. Not very well defined,
okay.
But clearly she was a person who had the best interests of the company in hand, she believed. She was doing mighty, mighty work in order to keep this company alive, to move it into a new marketplace, didn't believe that she had the support of the board because the principal investor and the chair said, this is not going to fly. And she took it to defend her on face value that that was a representation of the board as a whole. After all, he chose the two independent directors and he would generally would have had alignment with the other financial investors as well. And she would argue that there was absolute trade of fair value because the assets were stranded. They sat there earning nothing. And I'm giving you the opportunity to get immediately $700,000 worth of at least paper value out of them. And the business plan of the new venture suggests that in 3 years, that $700,000 will be worth about $80 million, 11 times the value at time of transfer. Mike.
But Mark, you said that sovereign fund did try to license the intellectual property. So the board really had two alternatives to consider, as did Brianna, but they were never presented with the two alternatives.
That's correct.
So I think that really is where the actions of the CEO were self-serving. She was not acting in the interest of the enterprise.
Mindy?
In other words, it was like self-dealing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think one of the issues is that these people didn't really look at kind of really the strategic plan in any coherent way. I mean, if someone says this is not working in this space and we're really not going to be able to make money from this, but these are alternatives, you sit down and you really figure out a plan of what you can really do with it and look at the market and the space so you understand if in fact what she's saying has some truth to it. They were like, we're sort of putting their heels in the ground and sort of saying, this is it, this is what we're doing, and we don't want to do anything else. They kind of had their blinders on, and they were not really looking at it from all angles, if you will, and that there was no money to be made in that continuing that.
So that was Ed himself that said that, not
the rest of the board.
No.
They had brought up the issue about the other board members. I guess if I was another board member, I'd be livid.
At who?
Possibly Ed.
Yeah.
We should have done this deal, and this, you know, Michigas wouldn't be here right now, and we'd be making some other money in some other areas.
And you ought not to have spoken in my behalf.
That's right. I should be
bring
able
it to the board.
Give my opinion to that.
But, you know, if we take this issue, take it to a little higher level.
Please.
Isn't this very typical of private equity-dominated boards?
It is.
Yes.
I mean, this is not, you know, in the first case, you've got this really just weird shit going on. This one, this is like your archetype private equity board, yeah, where one guy just, he's my board, I'm in control. And he's talking to the founder, and he says, this is what you're going to do.
And the founder's saying,
fuck you.
I can figure a way to do it. I can figure a way to do it.
So I have a threshold question for you. I'm the only probably non-board person here in the room. When does it become something for the public board discussion, and when is it the CEO's? Forget the fact that she moved to this competing, that's going to be the CEO. Let's say that would never happen. At what point is the threshold reached when it has to become not just daily operating procedure, but it becomes something extraordinary that requires
Well, this is a private company. Right. Even so, I think it has to be
spelled out. I don't think there's a general rule about what a CEO can do or can't do. I think there has to be, I agree with you, it has to be spelled out.
So, but boards meet every so often, right? They have a schedule.
Yeah.
When does it become, you know, all hands on deck meeting when you call board members in? I mean,
when
what should have happened, I guess, in this case?
When something has to be approved by them. And this did not have to be approved by them.
Should it have been?
Maybe, mm-hmm, but it didn't have to be.
I have a public company where they buy and sell stuff all the time without the board approval. Mm-hmm. And the first question I asked was, what's required? And the board said,
you trust the CEO.
Basically. Yeah.
And but if the CEO had done this and became, you know, jumped ship to
that's
join the answer.
That's a whole different.
I mean, it comes down to materiality and what the board dictates as to what the process or levels of approvals are going to be, and they just have to do that.
The standard for me is a reasonableness.
Yeah.
How outside of the norm was this transaction? And do you have a duty in a questionable circumstance to bring that action to the board? And it becomes almost an undefined, like pornography, you know it when you see it, but I can't define it, as one of Justice Blackmun said a long time ago.
Wasn't
Blackmun? Okay, Potter Stewart then, that's fair enough. But notwithstanding, clearly this was a circumstance where the CEO knew that she was doing something, albeit for the benefit of the company, that was outside of the norm. Mm-hmm. And on an undefined basis, you had the responsibility of bringing something outside of the norm to the board. The board itself started acting outside of the norm. And it acted outside of the norm because, A, it let a private equity-dominated board, single person, de facto control the opinions of the rest of the board. And he allowed himself to speak on behalf of an entire board. And there's no liability policy, professional errors and omissions insurance in the world that will cover that circumstance. None whatsoever.
So the more
egregious of the behaviors, in my view, was Ed's behavior.
I think so.
And not the chief executive's behavior.
I was going to ask the question. She's left the room. We're now in the board room, and we're all Ed's appointees, essentially.
Yes.
And I'm looking at Ed, and I'm saying, okay, you're pissed, and I suppose we are too. What happens if we fire her? What are the consequences? That would be the first question I would ask.
Okay.
And we'll probably say, gee, they would probably not be good. Then we would have a real discussion about what we should do.
So you can't fire her.
That's right.
Because she's already resigned.
That's right.
She's already resigned.
What if we accept
and
her
you
resignation?
And you can't. And she wants you to accept her resignation. And you can't fire her from the new joint venture because you have no control over the new joint venture. None whatsoever.
I say, well done, Brianna.
But you know, this gets into a discussion we had several months ago with Kathy Fogel. And she presented the issue about independent versus powerful board members.
Yes.
And this is very typical where you have legally independent people, but they're not very powerful because they're dependent on the private equity partner for their roles.
Right.
And you know, again, if I was advising this board, advising the private equity guy, I said, you know, maybe you need some people that you respect on the board that you'd want to get their opinion. But again, knowing private equity people, they won't want that opinion.
It's all hubris.
Oh, yeah.
Let me share with you the conclusion or where it sits at the moment, okay? The suspicion on the front side was that the chief executive was the bad actor, and exclusively the bad actor. And a third party I got brought in to repair the circumstance and punish the bad actor. I came to the opinion that the CEO was not the bad actor. She was not entirely clean.
Yeah.
Not entirely clean. She was a good person who did a wrong thing, but she did it for what she firmly believed to be the right reasons.
Did the wrong thing for the right reasons. Yes. Isn't that a line out of some play?
but she did. And she is the only person with the capacity to actually craft some value out of everybody's investment that's been made, because the investment in Exeter is not going to return even the cost of capital to even the $44 million to everybody. And the only way to get that $44 million back is to assure that the joint venture actually performs. It was a very hard message for my sponsor, the private equity entity, to hear. I had to take the stance that I, to use Larry's word, didn't give a shit what happened in the end and stand up.
Has he hired you again?
He has not hired me again. He's although I have yet to be fired. I have yet to be fired. I'm still in the engagement. But I insisted, because heretofore I had never had a conversation with the board, the entire board, including those members of the board, the other investors, nor the so-called independent investors. I had a presentation before the board and suggested the following as a conclusion: that you need to sell or mothball, be comfortable with the stagnant performance of Exeter, and the judgment has been made to sell Exeter and get some, we hope, as high as 72 or 75 cents on the dollar, and allow Brianna to continue. Don't contest her ability to do so. Allow Brianna to continue to run the new joint venture. That Brianna had to pay some cost for her misfeasance. And the negotiation is ongoing right now, where Brianna will transfer some level of ownership, yet to be determined, to the original investors. So instead of the company owning, the original investors of the company now owning 7% of the joint venture, and by the way, that will be transferred outside of the sale of Exeter, that will be transferred to the investors. And some larger proportion, not yet determined, but some big chunk of her 30% ownership, and some smaller chunk of the remaining ownership of management, which she plucked largely out of Exeter, will be transferred to the original investors. So my own guess is that that Thames and the original investors will end up at about 21 or 25% ownership in the joint venture, and that they need to go whole hog into supporting the new venture, ought to be consider buying into the new venture as well in order to increase their stake and not be diluted as new dollars come in, and that the third party sovereign fund was in effect their savior. And that's the conclusion.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'd like to thank Mark very much.
Absolutely.
We continue to stay in schmooze if you'd like. December, we typically do not try to compete with corporate Christmas parties. So we'll see you in January. Have a great holiday season and see you in the new year.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.